United States against Traeger. Just hold on, Mr. Vincent, till we make this switch. Mr. Vincent.
Good morning. May it please the court, for the record, Joshua Vincent on behalf of the defendant appellant Andrew Traeger. There are two issues I'd like to address with the court this morning in the time that we have, and the first concerns the district court's failure to hold an evidentiary hearing on a claim of prosecutorial misconduct, and the second concerns a failure to appoint counsel for Mr. Traeger at sentencing. With regard to the first issue, Mr. Traeger testified as a defense witness in a case subsequent to his prosecution here, in a case called U.S. versus McClurg, and during the course of that proceeding, the U.S. assistant U.S. attorney, who happened to be the same one who participated in this prosecution here, revealed or suggested that one of the key witnesses against Mr. Traeger in his case had testified under a grant of immunity. Now, that was the first time Mr. Traeger had heard about that. That had never been revealed to him or his counsel during the period involving his prosecution. And as a result of that, his court-appointed counsel filed a motion for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence of prosecutorial misconduct. The government filed a response to that motion in which it contended that the assistant U.S. attorney's questions that were asked at the McClurg prosecution were simply an error or mistaken. And the concern that I have on Mr. Traeger's behalf is that I don't see how the district court could brush this issue aside without a hearing. There is a clear conflict between...
Well, one reason might be that Traeger asked for a hearing and then explicitly, in open court, withdrew his request.
Well, the government's argument is waiver, Your Honor. But I think that
there... And withdrawing your request for a hearing and expressly telling the district judge you don't want it is pretty good waiver.
That's not what I think he did on this record. In this record, there's two different pleadings that his court-appointed counsel filed on this issue. And the first pleading, which is dated March 27th of 2000, appears in the record, March 27th, 2000, it's attached to a document Mr. Traeger filed, had a number of errors in it. Mr. Traeger appeared in front of Judge Shader 3 days later on March 31st, and at that time, his court-appointed counsel indicated Mr. Traeger wants to fire me because there's all these errors and misspellings in the document that I filed.
But the errors were misspellings.
No, not entirely, because he confused the names of two of the witnesses. He referred to the key witness who had the grant of immunity as Paul Goodman.
No surprise when you've got a counsel du jour system.
Well, that is another issue in this case.
I'm not surprised you haven't been fired yet.
Well, there's
still
time.
I haven't seen any spelling errors. I didn't see any spelling errors in your brief. You're safe.
I proofread very carefully. The point, though, is that at that hearing, Mr. Collins, that attorney, tendered to the court a corrected motion. And then you'll see in Mr. Traeger's motion to discharge him, there is a handwritten interlineation on that motion in which he says that the only document he wants the district court to disregard is the one with the errors. So I think what occurred here is that Mr. Traeger very carefully, with surprising care for a pro se defendant, actually made a conscious choice to abandon the defective pleading in favor of the corrected one that his counsel tendered to the court that day, because he hadn't seen the corrected one. And it's clear from the colloquy that takes place between the court and counsel and Mr. Traeger. Mr. Traeger's attorney said, I haven't had a chance to show him this document yet.
And it's clear that the judge believes that this has been withdrawn. And it's also clear that Judge Shader at this point invites Traeger, if he really wishes to pursue it, to file a new motion.
Yes.
I take it he never did.
No, he did. And
what
he filed...
No, he did.
I'm sorry. Yes, he did. He did file another motion in response to the judge's request. And that motion is dated 3 days after this hearing. It appears in the record at docket entry 117, I believe. Yes, 117. That was not included in the original record on appeal. We have asked the district court to supplement the record with it. But in that document, and, you know, I will grant you, it's a pro se document.
What,
it's
what's
imperfect.
The status of this motion to supplement?
As far as I know, that motion was granted. There was no objection from the government. We filed the motion in front of Judge Shader a week ago Friday. Was when that was up for hearing, so that should have been transmitted to the court by now. But in that motion, and it's imperfect, I don't deny that, the judge said you need to file a motion for leave to do something. And you'll see this document at docket entry 117, where it's filed a motion to leave, not motion for leave, and it refers again...
What most defendants would like.
Yes. But he says motion to leave, and then it goes on to refer to the discharge of counsel again, and I think that's probably because Mr. Traeger didn't understand what exactly the further motion Judge Shader had asked him to file would be. But in the body of that motion, he goes on to complain that he wants the evidentiary hearing, and that the reason
with
he discharged...
With respect to the question about whether or not there
misconduct.
Was immunity.
Yes, prosecutorial misconduct. And he explains that that's why he terminated his last counsel, Mr. Mezick.
He just fired him. The CIA terminates people.
I'll go with discharge then.
All right. Let me ask you another question about this. This is a sort of strange dispute of fact, it seems to me, with respect to the immunity question, because it's Mr. Fullerton, right? Mr. Fullerton, in the other trial, refers to an immunity grant from Ms. Anderson.
Yes.
And then when Mr. Traeger follows up on that, Mr. Fullerton files an affidavit with Judge Shader, right, in which he says, functionally, I misspoke. There had been conversations about immunity, but in the end we didn't have to do it. And we don't usually find a dispute of facts when a single witness in a deposition and, you know, orally and in some sort of affidavit says two different things. It's usually you have some sort of external evidence. I understand Mr. Traeger wanted this hearing so he could also put Ms. Anderson on the stand and say,
that's
was
correct.
There ever any kind of discussion of this? But it's an odd dispute of fact. The judge seems to have taken the affidavit as Mr. Fullerton's better recollection and didn't think it was necessary for a hearing.
With all due respect, John, I think that overstates the record. I don't think Judge Shader ever addressed this in any respect. There is nothing by Judge Shader after the government's response is filed that mentions this issue at all. There's nothing to indicate that some acknowledgement that the defendant has withdrawn it. There's nothing to suggest that. There's no action taken at all. Frankly, what I think happened is, you know, and I've seen this mentioned in other cases, maybe it just got lost in the shuffle. I don't know.
Well,
one thing I do know,
thought that it had been withdrawn. I think back to what Judge Easterbrook was saying.
I don't know that that's really fair either, simply because there's
no... it had been explicitly withdrawn in open court, and somehow a document captioned motion to leave to file the enclosed motion for dismissal of counsel pro se ad hoc wouldn't really alert a judge that this was a Giglio request.
In the body of it, it does, Your Honor. Now, I agree, maybe the title is, you know, troublesome, but that would be certainly elevating form over substance. And the substance of the motion explains very clearly that he fired this lawyer for not pressing this issue. I'm sorry.
You know, I have a hard time finding that that was such a material, even assuming that Fullerton didn't misspeak and there was an immunity grant, that Anderson was even a key witness here. You got the identifications of,
her testimony.
You've got his statement to the FBI agent about that.
Her testimony goes to the issue of intent. She is the accomplice who cased the bank for Mr. Traeger, according to the government. She is an admitted prostitute.
But see, I just looked at this case and thought they wouldn't have any trouble convicting this fellow without her testimony.
I think that when you have the bank teller at the Grant Bank, who is not a native English speaker, and part of the defense is that she may have misunderstood what he was saying, and you have that in conflict with a cab driver who has testified.
He walked out of the bank with the first, the bank he actually robbed, he walked out with $5,200 or something.
$5,840.
Where's the intent issue there?
That doesn't relate to the LaSalle Bank robbery at all. The only issue we're relating Pauline Anderson's testimony to is intent to commit attempted robbery of the Great Bank. And the other bank, the LaSalle Bank, is not implicated by this testimony. But you have, I mean, the evidence is almost balanced on the issue of intent. You've got the teller who says, I think he was trying to rob us, but doesn't, you know, is clearly, clearly, is equivocal in her testimony about what transpired in terms of the communication. You've got the cab driver who says Mr. Traeger was telling him all along he's looking for a bank to invest in, make a deposit, having difficulty at this bank because of problems with asking for too many forms of identification. And I think if the jury is confronted with those two, Pauline Anderson's testimony that he asked me to case the bank before he went in there clearly tips the balance to the government's side. And I think if you had an opportunity to, I mean, this is a woman who clearly was an accomplice. She went to the bank with him. She cased the bank first. She's not charged with anything. And it, to me, that's a very peculiar circumstance that there wasn't some possible quid pro quo involved here that could have colored her testimony and made a difference in front of a jury.
Spending time with him, isn't she?
Yes, she was. And for her to now testify against him, in spite of that, suggests to me that maybe there was some quid pro quo or some suggestion of it. And that's what, I mean, we're speculating, and that's the whole reason. I mean, we're talking about the possibility of prosecutorial misconduct, and that's a serious matter, and one that I think warrants, at a minimum, an evidentiary hearing. And where is the harm in an evidentiary hearing on that issue? I don't think that is a significant departure for the court to allow that type of process on this record. The other issue I wanted to talk about very briefly is the issue of sentencing and the failure to appoint counsel on that point. And what the arguments have boiled down to in the briefs is primarily a question of whether this was a knowing and voluntary waiver of the right to counsel on sentencing. And the one thing I'd ask the court to focus on in that context is there's the four factors that the court considers on knowing waivers, and that's context. At the time Mr. Traeger discharged his counsel, Mr. Mezick, it's clear from the transcripts where that transpired that he was very upset about the fact that Mr. Mezick had not pressed for an evidentiary hearing on this misconduct issue, had not pressed for an evidentiary hearing on his ineffective assistance claims. And at that point, when he discharges him, that to me triggers the type of inquiry where the judge should be looking at, is this man making too hasty a decision about counsel? He's thinking about something that's already done, and he's not thinking about what's coming up next, which is the sentencing hearing. And at that point, I do think it's incumbent on the district judge to give some warning or some counsel to indicate that, you know, sentencing is coming up. You may want to have a lawyer for that. There are disadvantages if you don't. And that warning is not given in this case at all. And to me, that's troublesome for two reasons. One, because I think that in context of what was occurring here, that should have triggered that type of warning. But second of all, when you look at some of the cases that are cited in the briefs, one of them, this Aurier case involving Judge Shader, the same district judge here, he gave that type of warning, mentioned the difficulties, and appoints shadow counsel. And to me, for that to occur in Aurier and not to have occurred here at all, suggests to me a lack of even-handedness that I think warrants a resentencing on this. This man has been sentenced as a career offender. When you look at his response to the pre-sentence report, he has no clue what he's arguing about there. And there is an issue, I think, about an old conviction in this case that may have been his third strike. But he had no counsel to help him with this process. And I think his right to have counsel at sentencing was violated in this case, and I don't think the government can establish any waiver of that right under these circumstances. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Vincent. Mr. Bindi.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Mr. Vincent has argued here this morning that Mr. Traeger preserved the request for a hearing on the prosecutorial misconduct issue in two ways. First, he says that Mr. Traeger preserved this issue because in the act of firing the lawyer who raised it, Gerald Collins, Mr. Traeger submitted a pro se pleading which contained...
How long was which lawyer in sequence, number two or number three?
He was the first lawyer post-trial.
He was the second
where
lawyer.
Where is that in sequence? Is that his second lawyer or his third lawyer? Or his fourth?
I believe, Your Honor, the record shows that Mr. Traeger was initially represented at the arraignment or in the detention and preliminary hearing stage by Mr. Murphy from the Federal Defender Program. I believe that subsequent to that, Mr. Clark took on his representation and represented him through trial.
Mm-hmm.
After the trial was over, Gerald Collins stepped in and prepared post-trial motions on his behalf. And then after Collins came Mr. Metchik.
So
Collins was retained, wasn't he?
Initially he was retained.
Right. And then later appointed.
And then
Collins
later appointed.
Is the third lawyer. And a fourth lawyer is actually appointed before sentencing.
Correct.
Right, so I'm trying to figure out in part the significance to make of this peculiar pro se document, which is now in the record.
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I was going to get to that. I'll get to it now.
I'm just trying to figure out the significance. He has another lawyer before the district court finally says, I'm giving up. You're going to have to represent yourself pro se.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. Now, in the sequence of events, it is in March of 2000 that Mr. Collins' motion for a new trial based on this newly discovered evidence of prosecutorial misconduct is presented. Shortly after it is presented, there is a proceeding in court in which Mr. Traeger asks to have Collins taken off the case.
Could I just nail down the sequence, too? Is it that Traeger files this thing, then Collins files the one with the witness names wrong and the misspelling and all of that, but Collins orally says at that hearing, oh, I've prepared a corrected one. Traeger, as far as it appears on the record, fires Collins at that point and says, I want the motion withdrawn. But then I understood Mr. Vincent to say he has a handwritten note in the second of those motions, which I guess has reverted to pro se status after Collins is fired. So he's got that signal to the district court that these issues are still on the table, and then this thing a few days later, the motion to leave.
No. We've missed a year here, Judge.
Oh, there's a whole year that
there's
motion
a
to
whole
leave is a year,
year that's,
later?
That's intervening in here.
Okay.
When he fires Collins, he does make a notation on a pro se pleading asking to preserve the corrected motion. Okay, but a month, actually a little bit less than a month after that, we're now in April of 2000, is when Mr. Metchik comes into the case, initially as retained counsel.
Right.
Okay. And our argument about this handwritten notation, I want to preserve the corrected motion, is that once Mr. Metchik comes into the case and files pleadings on Traeger's behalf, the district judge is not required to consider both counsel's pleadings and pro se pleadings.
So you're saying the Metchik pleadings, as a matter of law, supersede
the Metchik pleadings,
Collins.
Our position is that the Metchik pleadings erase everything that's happened before them.
Okay.
Now, Mr. Traeger allows Mr. Metchik's pleading to go to a ruling by Judge Shader, and Judge Shader denies the motion. Now we are into February of 2001. After that post-trial motion by Metchik is denied, the following month, in March of 2001, there is a proceeding in court. That proceeding takes place on March 23rd. The timing here now, I think, is very important because this gets to the second issue of how he says he preserved this issue. We're now on March 23rd of 2001. And again, Mr. Traeger is unhappy with his lawyer. And on March 23rd, they appear in court. Metchik is given leave to withdraw. And Judge Shader, Traeger orally tells Judge Shader, I still think that there should be a hearing on this prosecutorial misconduct issue, at least on that one. Judge Shader says, we've been 2 years now since the end of this 3-day trial, and your post-trial motion has been denied, and we're going to set things up for sentencing now. I'm going to set a date. But I'll tell you what, Mr. Traeger, if you still think that there are issues out there that I should consider and that maybe I should hold a hearing on, then I will allow you to file something. But it has to be in the form of a motion for leave to do something. Now, the contention has been made here this morning that this document, docket entry, I think 117, was the motion subsequent to that hearing which preserves this issue. It is not. The motion was docketed, entered on the clerk's docket 3 days later on March 23rd. But it is file stamped March 23rd, the day of the hearing. And the notice that Mr. Traeger prepared himself indicates that the motion was prepared on March 20th, 3 days prior to this hearing. This is the pleading by which Traeger notified Judge Shader that he wanted to get rid of Metchik. It was the first thing that was discussed at the hearing on the 23rd. When Judge Shader said, well, I've read your submission, Mr. Traeger, I'm paraphrasing here, I read your submission and I've looked at what you've submitted, and it looks to me like you want to get rid of Mr. Metchik. Do I take that to mean that you now want to go pro se? And Traeger says yes.
Can I interrupt you right here and say, on the other issue, you know, on the sentencing counsel issue, I'm concerned that I can't find in this record anything like what we have looked for in cases like Hill and Avery and others, where Judge Shader says so much as, this is really a stupid thing to do, you know, or, you know, fancier words to that effect. You know, the kind of warning that we've looked for, we haven't insisted on any particular formula of words, but that extra caution before somebody actually takes the leap and asserts his Faretta rights once and for all.
Well, Judge, you're right. There isn't anything in the record where Judge Shader gives a warning, where he says, you know, about the pitfalls of self-representation. On the other hand, a very minimal sort of warning, twice mentioning the difficulties of self-representation, was found adequate in the ORI case. And that case was a case in which the defendant was going to represent himself at trial. This is a situation where Traeger was going to represent himself at sentencing, and I submit that the pitfalls of self-representation at a sentencing hearing are not quite as deep.
Why is that? Given that there are no rules of evidence at a sentencing hearing.
Well, but there...
your offense, with given the relevant conduct rules and career criminal rules, can suddenly balloon up into something much...
Well, but there's no dispute in this case that Traeger qualified as a career offender. I mean, even now on appeal, there's no contention that the sentence was improperly determined.
But you say there's no legal difference between the kind of minimal warning that happened in Irere and zero warning?
I don't think it makes a difference in this case, considering that we're looking at the difference between trial and sentencing. And I would also point out to the court that Mr. Traeger did ask Judge Shader about one thing in anticipation of sentencing. Mr. Traeger anticipated giving what turned out to be a somewhat eloquent allocution at his sentencing hearing. But he asked Judge Shader, in effect, if I say anything that could be construed or constitute an admission of guilt, would that come back to haunt me if I win a new trial on appeal? And Judge Shader told him at the sentencing hearing, having had, I think, his law clerks research the issue, the answer to your question, Mr. Traeger, is yes. And Mr. Traeger's allocution at sentencing hearing is somewhat lengthy, and it walks the tightrope between a plea for mercy without constituting an admission of guilt. I would note also Mr. Metchik, as he departed the case on March 23, 2001, told Judge Shader that Andrew Traeger was a very committed and involved man in his own defense and was probably the best person to represent himself.
Well, I can imagine all of these lawyers reached a level of frustration with Mr. Traeger. That seems to be apparent on the record. But that's the other thing Judge Shader doesn't do. He doesn't say to Mr. Metchik, would you stand by as shadow counsel, or would you in some other way, just in case Mr. Traeger, being obviously a fairly able person, if he suddenly decides he needs some advice. There's nothing like that either here.
That's true, Your Honor. There is no offer of shadow counsel or standby counsel. But again, the Ori case notes that where you get standby counsel who ends up taking a very active role in the defense of the case, you're really getting more than you're entitled to. You're getting hybrid representation, and the law does not require that. As a matter of fact, the law frowns on that. So, Your Honor, we would respectfully request that this court affirm the judgment. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bindi. Anything further, Mr. Benson?
I'm troubled by the fact that this motion is filed, and even though the government contends that Mr. Traeger withdrew it at that hearing, they file a response to it anyway. If the motion was withdrawn before Judge Shader at the hearing in March of 2000, why did the government file a lengthy written response to it? I mean, that to me indicates that there was no understanding that this motion was withdrawn at all, that this was still very much in play. The second thing I wanted to point out is that the timing of docket entry 117, that is dated as filed March 26, 3 days after the hearing before Judge Shader. Mr. Bindi says that that's the motion that Traeger filed to discharge Metchik, but I believe, I don't have the docket in front of me, I believe there are two. I believe there is another motion to discharge Metchik that precedes the motion to leave, proceed pro se ad hoc that we're referring to. So I feel that that is the motion in which he responded to the judge's invitation. On the issue of the sentencing, counsel says there's no question about the sentence, but you know, to me, when you're talking about someone who's received career offender status, that raises a red flag under these circumstances where he should have had counsel. And the fact that he made an elocution that Mr. Bindi now construes as an admission of guilt, to me, points up the fact that this man clearly needed counsel at sentencing. For those reasons, we would ask that you vacate.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bindi. Mr. Vincent. And we also